from KQED.
Good evening and welcome to this KQED Public Radio Public Affairs Special. I'm Tara Seiler. California's first tax revolt took place in the late 1970s. During Jerry Brown's first term as governor, voters passed Proposition 13 to roll back property taxes and require a two-thirds majority for lawmakers to raise any tax. Today, Californians say they want great schools and universities, effective infrastructure, long prison terms, and a social safety net for the poor. But they still don't want to pay more taxes. So, Governor Brown, in his second stay in office, is fighting an uphill battle for a measure asking voters to chip in more. This election has become a referendum on the size and scope of government. On September 20th, 2012, a program titled Tax Revolt 2.0, Who Will Pay for the Society We Want, was presented at the David Brower Center in Berkeley. The event was co-sponsored by KQED, UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy, and Cal Alumni Association. A group of close observers to California politics were brought together for this program and asked to share their views and vision. The program was moderated by KQED's Scott Schaefer.
So tonight we are going to tackle a really big topic, and although I'm not sure we're going to have solutions, I'm hoping we'll have maybe break some new ground. This is an ambitious topic, but I think we have four panelists who are up to the task, and I'm sure you know all of them or most of them, but let me introduce them real quickly. On the end there, Deborah Saunders is a nationally syndicated columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. She's also written for the Wall Street Journal and the National Review, and she's author of the book, The World According to Gore. Welcome. And next to her, Henry Brady is the dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and a political scientist and economist. In his most recent book, The Unheavenly Chorus, Unequal Political Voice and the Broken Promise of American Democracy, he and his co-authors reveal just how skewed political influence has become. Henry Brady, welcome. And there in the middle, Robert Reich is the Chancellor's Professor at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy. He's a frequent contributor to NPR's Marketplace, served as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. Time magazine named him one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the last century. His latest book... His latest book, Beyond Outrage, just came out in paperback, and he's fresh off a CNN debate with Grover Norquist. So please welcome Robert Reich. And sitting right to my left, Michael J. Boskin. He's a Tully M. Friedman Professor of Economics and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Professor Boskin served as Chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors from 1989 to 1993. Welcome to you as well. Well, Bob Reich, I figure your blood pressure is high since you've just been talking with Grover Norquist. So let me start with you. We are, as we sit here today, California and local governments are in a whole bunch of distress. We've seen cities like Stockton and Vallejo declare bankruptcy. There's severe stress on pension systems. San Jose and San Diego, recently the voters there enacted fairly strict changes to their pension system. I want to just begin by asking you, is government at all levels in California too big? Are we just trying to do too much?
I don't think it's too big. First of all, I should preface my remarks by saying that I'm a relative newcomer here, which gives me a certain ability to be, shall we say, objective or at least not responsible. I would say it's not so much a question of size. What strikes me about California government, being somewhat of a student of government and a participant, is its dysfunctionality. That is, you get a combination of oddities in California that you have rarely seen in the history of parliamentary or Western democracy. I mean, you have a system that basically makes it almost impossible for legislators to make budget allocation decisions. This is a perverse legacy of the progressive era with regard to initiatives that tie legislators' hands. You do have a public employee sector that is very powerful. That's part of the problem and part of the solution. You also have a political culture that is just about the most partisan. Now, I spent years in Washington, and I thought that was the most partisan political culture I'd ever seen. But this is a remarkably, unusually partisan culture. I think it may change now that legislative districting is a little bit more rational. But
I'm sorry to interrupt you in mid-sentence, but are you saying, though, that it's dysfunctional, but if we could just figure that part out, we could afford everything we're doing?
I'm not sure we can afford what we're doing, but I think the roots of it come in just a set of processes and constraints that make whatever we do, that distort whatever we do. I think historically, and I hope the panel gets into this, I'm interested in a very simple fact. When I, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when I was growing up on the East Coast, and I looked to California, California was the best in terms of education, infrastructure, freeways, a government that seemed to be working in ways that the rest of the country envied. And what the question that I've continually asked myself is what happened?
Yeah. Well, let me just pick it up right there. Michael Boskin, what did happen? I mean, if you think back, I mean, everyone loves the 50s and the 60s in California, and then something happened. Is that how you see it? I mean, is that just, you know, sort of putting a fine gloss on history and, you know, the past always looks better than it really was? Or did something happen to change it? And what was it, and when did it happen?
I think many things happened, but it may surprise many of you to note that I do agree with a lot of what Bob just said. And I was especially appreciative of his generosity and in recognizing that even progressives sometimes enact policies that have negative unintended consequences. So I think that certainly the lack of flexibility has also, in the budget process, has created with it a lack of accountability. And that, in my opinion, is a big part of the problem. Just to give you a few facts, there are many aspects to this, and probably each of you will have your own interpretation of them. I'll give you mine in a second. But from the mid-80s, I think, when things really started to come apart, until just before this current crisis, because there is a recession and weak recovery part of it that is partly, at least, cyclical. There were 10 million more people in California, 7 million more Medicaid recipients, 150,000 more taxpayers with 10 million more people, and 115,000 more prison inmates. You could sort of, just from the arithmetic of the demography and those sorts of things, understand that, you know, left, right, wherever you are, something kind of didn't add up. We now are in a position where, with 12% of the population, we have one-third of the welfare recipients in the United States. We have many wonderful things going for us, including the University of California, which I remain a very proud alum of. We have a remarkable technology industry, entertainment, agriculture, although some policies are causing problems with it. We have a lot of other things going on. We also have some potential strengths that are short-run challenges that we seem to be arguing each other at without trying to figure out a way to make into strengths for California. For example, in a global economy, our extensive ethnic and linguistic diversity, we ought to be able to figure out a way to make that a strength rather than just a cost center. So all those things have happened, and I think a very large part of what's gone on is the point that Bob was making, he was attributing part of the problem to. California's become basically a one-party state, and it's the public employee unions crossed with a rather strident, extreme form of environmentalism. I think most Californians are really softcore environmentalists. And trial lawyers have created a bunch of policies which, however well-intentioned they may have seemed to those people, have caused a lot of manufacturing jobs, a lot of middle-class jobs to leave the state. So now California manages to be a high-tax state, not at the top in terms of personal income, but to do that with really high tax rates that affect decisions at the margin.
Let me just stop you there, because you've raised about four issues, and I want to come back to all of them. But Henry Brady, when you think about the roots of where we're at today and the problems we're having, Michael just talked about the mid-80s. I mean, where do you see it beginning?
Well, I think one of the most important things to know about California is this political economic fact. In the 50s and 60s, we were a very rich state compared to every other state in the United States. We were about 30% higher average income than other states. And we had a tax system that was sort of average in terms of its tax rates. But if you've got a very rich population with average taxes, you yield pretty high amount of revenues. And you can do lots of things. And we did do lots of things, like create the great University of California system, the CSU system, great water projects, and so forth. We are now at about 105% of the average state in terms of our personal income. So in other words, we're maybe 5% richer than those other states. By the way, when we were very rich, one of the reasons we were very rich is we got government contracts. It was the aerospace industry in the state of California that had very high wages and made a lot of people very well off. So one of the things that's happened is we are still a state with memories of being quite rich and therefore being able to do great things, but we're not as rich as we used to be, and therefore we've got to decide what our priorities are, and we're not doing a particularly good job of that. I don't think it's as bad as Michael says, by the way. I think, in fact, yeah, the labor unions are problematic in some areas, more problematic in some areas than others. Like in corrections, I think they're a real problem. And I think we've been held up by them to have an incredibly high cost of incarcerating people in this state. It's just ridiculous. I have a modest proposal I've made to turn the University of California into a series of prisons, because that way... It's a good idea. It's a good idea. That way we can...
You're sure your students don't feel that way already?
Well, they may. Oh, that's, yeah.
Stanford
that's me.
What do you expect?
Just teasing.
But, you know, they get $50,000 per prisoner. We get $10,000 per student.
Deborah Saunders, coming back to this notion of California being a one-party state. The legislature has been controlled essentially except for about 20 minutes, I think, when the Republicans had the speakership back in the 90s. We have had Republican governors, but what do you think that the fact that Democrats are so preeminent in the Republican Party, the wheels have come off the party in California, is that contributing to the situation we're in?
Well, I think Republicans do contribute to the situation because you need somebody to blame. So even though you have Democrats controlling the legislature, pumping up the spending beyond beyond what the state can afford, and even though in 2009, two-thirds of California voters rejected the last attempt at a tax increase, somehow it's always the fault of the fact that there weren't Republicans who voted for whatever new taxes Democrats wanted to have. I mean, that's something that keeps coming up. I think I look at the state and we're sort of leading the nation and not being responsible for what we want. I mean, this is a state where we've elected legislators who keep increasing the size of state government without ever paying for it.
In 2007-08, we had a budget which was $30 billion. The general fund budget was $30 billion bigger than it is today.
That's right. Because
$30 billion. That's a lot of cuts on a general fund budget that's now maybe $91 billion.
Well, you're looking at the general fund budget. You're not looking at the other budgets.
No,
that's what the state controls.
That's right. But the truth is that those... They've moved a lot of money off the general fund in order, but
$30 billion.
The thing is, you're right. We finally got to the point where voters said no, we're not going to pay more, and they've had to cut back. But why was it when we had the tech boom, that money just got spent too quickly? It became part of the base, and nobody knew how to correct
it.
Now, or cared to correct it.
And I know you
were right about that.
We can agree on that, I think. But there was no real mechanism for saving it, but they certainly started a lot of programs that had ongoing costs. You worked in Sacramento.
I did. I worked in the legislature.
In a different era, I think it's fair to say, because you worked for Pat Nolan, right?
He's been gone
for quite a long time. What's the difference? Why won't they talk to each other? Why don't they like each other? Why won't they? I mean, back then, Ken Matty and Willie Brown, they went out for a drink. They scribbled some things on a cocktail napkin, and they got things done. Now they don't even like
everybody
talk to each other.
That's what everybody says. You know, let me tell you a story about myself recently, which is in 2009, I voted for Proposition 1A, which had a half-cent sales tax increase and an increase in for income tax. I didn't like it, but I felt, okay, voters should, even if I wasn't one of the voters who voted for this stuff, you have to pay for it, and you have to work with the other side, and that's how politics should work. Well, so now Jerry Brown runs for governor, not saying that he'll raise taxes. He comes into the Chronicle with this big notebook.
Well, just as a point of clarification, he said he would put it to the voters.
That's right, but he didn't say he wanted to. He said, I'm not sure if I'll do it. Here are the ideas I have. But if I do, I won't do it without going to the voters. Comes in first month, says we have to raise taxes. And he comes out and he puts together, and he can't get any Republicans to go along with him. Well, you'll forgive me, but the year before, two-thirds of California voters in a blue state said no to a tax hike.
So he comes up with this new idea. And it's very similar at first to what Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to do. But he can't sell it. He knows that the Federation of Teachers has its plan. They call it a millionaire's tax. And he decides that I'm getting to the point, I promise.
Okay.
And he decides that he has to make it a more progressive tax, which is another, we haven't even gotten into how that has contributed to the state's problems. The problem with a progressive income tax is that it goes like this. It's not steady. You need a stable revenue
stream. Well,
that's
true of the income tax generally.
But the more progressive it is, the worse it is. Right? We all
right,
agree
exactly,
on that?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's volatile.
So what does he do? He makes it so I can't vote for this tax increase that he's putting forward because it's just so progressive, I think it's going to destroy the state.
That's
what's happening in politics in this state.
Can we be? I just want to make sure that we're together on something because I think we all agree that the problem with progressivity is the volatility. But that doesn't mean that progressivity is bad. You could conceivably, theoretically, iron out the volatility if you had a rainy day fund, if you require that surpluses in 1 year be put and applied to the possibility of that the business cycle is not always going up, it will be going down. It's important that we recognize, it seems to me, that this state has assets that very few other states have. I mean, the reason that high-tech, I mean, Apple and Google and every other major, and Facebook wants to come here and came here, the reason that we have the venture capital, the largest and probably richest venture capital industry in this country, the reason entertainment is the major, one of the major exports of the United States, and it is here in California, we are doing remarkably well. The problem is the term we. Who is we, Kemosabe? Some Californians are doing remarkably well, but many Californians are doing very, very poorly. And I think that is a very important aspect of the problem. The problem is not that we have a progressive income tax. The problem is that we have raging inequality, and we are not doing what we could and should be doing with regard to public investments like education.
Michael?
Well, first of all, a state, an individual...
You're in Berkeley, Mike.
I know that. An individual state is poorly suited to be far out of line with the people, the states and the countries it's competing with. An individual state, whatever the values are of the people, and if they all have Berkeley values, want extreme progressivity, the progressive experiment in California has just run aground. We can't afford now to provide basic services to people that should be able to rely on us for police, for parks, for education. We need a much more stable revenue base. One of the problems with a highly progressive tax system, which we're about to have the highest tax rates in the country, and we have by far the most volatile state revenue system and one of the most progressive ones and about to become the most progressive, is also the incentives it creates. Bob named some companies that are very famous here. They expand elsewhere. They primarily expand elsewhere. That's a big problem. We've got a lot of assets here. We also have a lot of things we don't do. You know, we all care about the environment. California has vast resources, mineral resources, which refuses to allow people to develop, even under tight environmental restrictions that could raise tens of billions of dollars of revenue. So there's a lot involved here, but I do want to say that at its core is the notion that we can have a small fraction of the population who's highly mobile, who can move income out of the state, can move themselves out of the state, can move their businesses or expand their business out of the state, should pay a vastly disproportionate share of the taxes. So even if you believe in a progressive income tax, 1% of the population paying half the income tax, the main revenue device, back in the days Bob was pointing to that he thought California was doing great back in the 50s and 60s, the income tax was a small minority partner in the state's revenue system. It was mostly the sales tax. That's eroded, partly because we've taken a lot of people off the income tax, partly because some types of income have been removed with deductions and credits, both at the federal and state level that ought to be dealt with.
But isn't the
But also, let me just finish this. So that's one part. But also, so the income tax has exploded, and it's a big problem. We have a very high corporate rate. We have a lot of deductions. We have a very high corporate rate. We have...
But total business taxes aren't that high.
But corporations...
Businesses have property taxes that are quite low in this state. So the total business tax It's corporation tax is high, you're right. But let's look at total business tax, because that's what matters ultimately for corporations. They're not just concerned about one tax. They're concerned about their entire tax burden.
And when you look at that, we were between Nevada and Ohio.
When they look at what they're going to do, they look at the different taxes they pay. So if they have high property taxes, and that is not, they're not getting the services that they think those taxes should pay for, they will do other things. They will not expand their physical presence here. They'll move out of the state. And that's been going on considerably.
But they don't have high
property
taxes.
There's this notion that the property tax, California is way low on property taxes. Here's the data. Per capita, California property taxes are dead center of the 50 states. Relative to personal income, we're still a high personal income state, not as high as we used to be, still well above average. They are about 35th or 36th. So it's the only tax that isn't really high. And it came about because of the same volatile budgeting. In the 70s, in Jerry Brown's first term in office, first time around, he had two terms then, but his first time in Sacramento, he was running large surpluses and a roaring inflation when people's property taxes were being jacked up for purely inflationary gains when their inflation-adjusted wages weren't going up. So they complained about it, and he kept building a bigger and bigger surplus. So he opened the door
for
somebody to be
there. Let's make a deal. You give me the property tax back, and we'll lower the income tax.
Can I mention one? And then we
solve some of the volatility problem, because the property tax typically is not that volatile. That probably wouldn't have been true in this last financial downturn, but typically it's not that volatile.
Well, you may have noticed that housing values collapsed, and so this is the first time property taxes have collapsed, so it would have been particularly untimely this time.
I agree with that. That's why I said
what
I said.
The fact is,
generally speaking,
the fact
property
matter
taxes
is,
are a pretty stable source of income.
Does anybody care that we have the third highest unemployment rate in the country?
Yeah, the third highest of any state.
You know,
does that matter at all?
Yeah.
Of course it matters.
Well, so I think the thing we need to be figuring out is how we can have a more competitive, sensible environment for businesses to grow here and add jobs.
Well, and part of
there are obviously differences of opinions about how to do that between Republicans and Democrats, but there ought to be some notion that we could have a more stable, less progressive income tax on a broader base. When I was on a commission that Governor Schwarzenegger and the Democratic heads of the Senate and the Assembly appointed, we came up with a bipartisan proposal that would broaden the tax base, make it only half as volatile as it was over the business cycle, collect the same revenue on average over the business cycle, and actually be a tax cut for Californians because more of it would be deductible against federal income taxes. We need to have that kind of thinking, and we need to have that kind of thinking not just on the revenue side but on the spending side, which I hope we'll get to, because there are precious few California spending programs that couldn't deliver more per dollar, and we need to get more per dollar, better results, better outcomes from everything from our prisons, which Henry mentioned.
I want to go back to the Barbara. Question of constraints with regard to budgeting and allocating money. I mean, to me, the greatest scandal of California is that we now are, 49th out of 50th in terms of K through 12 education. I thank God for Mississippi. I mean, I say every day. And the jewel in the crown, which was the University of California at Berkeley, and the entire master plan that used to provide access to higher education for any qualified California student, that is basically disintegrating. This is our seed corn. I mean, this is what made California in terms of what we're proudest of in California and what economic development really depends on. If we want to become a high-wage state, if we want to have high tax, maybe not a high tax rate, but at least high tax revenues, if we want to be able to afford what needs to be done, we have got to invest fundamentally in education and in infrastructure. We're not doing it. We're not doing it well. And that seems to me the critical issue.
Deborah Saunders, you mentioned the unemployment rate in California, which is high. But, you know, companies like Google and Apple, they want to hire people from California, and they often can't find folks who are qualified, and they go outside the state or outside the country. And I'm just wondering, what obligation do you think the state does have to education to make sure that we are educating kids K through 12 and then beyond?
Well, obviously, we have an obligation to educate children. The question is, does spending more money increase the education that they get? And there have been a number of studies that have looked at per pupil spending, and they don't see a nexus between its increase and what kids learn. A few years ago, we spent about $10,000 per student. We're below that now because we've spent our way beyond all reason. I just have to tell you, though, I don't know if you want to keep increasing taxes in order to deal with that. You're just going to chase more businesses out of here and have less revenue. We've hit this point. I mean, we have the third highest unemployment rate in the country. People don't see it here because San Francisco is booming, which is great. The Bay Area is doing well. But the rest of the state is in...
But Deb, that's why we need to connect the dots and why education is so central. What we know in this state and the rest of the states is a tremendous correlation between unemployment and education levels. College graduates, four-year college graduates now nationally have a 4.4% unemployment rate. California is not that different for college graduates. If you get down to high school dropouts or even people with just a high school degree, you have much, much higher levels of unemployment. And that's why, again, education is so critical. I'm not suggesting we raise taxes for education necessarily. My point only was that with the constraints, the straitjacket with regard to budgeting, we necessarily have to spend money for things that may not be nearly as high a priority.
You'll get no argument from me on that score. I do not like the way we put the budget.
I agree with that. I think it's worth mentioning, however, that I think Bob's right. It's important we have a much better educational outcomes, but that's not going to do much for the unemployment rate right now. That's going to be something that's going to affect us over decades, not over a few quarters. So it's really not a solution to our current or immediate short-term problems. That's number one.
If everybody goes to school, does everybody have a job? Yeah. Or is there a limit to how many college graduates an economy can support?
I understand you have to go to school, and I'm sensitive to that. I'd also like to have a state where you're likely to get a good job. And that's going to require a lot of changes in California. Let me come back to the spending. I'm in favor. I think a successful society needs an effective government doing the essential functions of government and the revenues sufficient to fund them over the business cycle. And in the state, just every year, and the federal government over the business cycle. I'm sure on this panel we disagree on how effusively we would define what the necessary functions of government are. But the point is, spending doesn't necessarily equate to outcomes. If that was true, Washington, D.C. would have the best public schools in the country, and California's prisons would be the envy of the world. Diminishing returns set in when you keep pouring more money into the same broken process in the public sector, just like they do in various aspects in the private sector, just like these guys teach at Berkeley in their introductory economics courses. So the point is, how do we figure out a way both to fix this governance issue that has rightly been mentioned about the inflexibility, but try to figure out serious substantive reforms focused on doing better for our kids with better education.
Like what?
For example, a lot more choice in education, a lot more competition. That's number one. Number two, the University of California has serious budget problems right now. We can get back to discussing those. But at UC and at the CSU system, why aren't we wheeling units like we do electrons? We've got kids that are taking 6 years because they say they can't get courses. Why don't we wheel them? We have to get much more serious about online education. Chris Edley has some great ideas here at the law school in Berkeley. We're going to have to do those things regardless of whatever the outcome of the initiative this year and all that sort of stuff is. We have to fundamentally rethink how we deliver services, what our responsibilities are, and how to do that effectively. And it's very, very, look, it's not easy to do this when you're in a private company. But you have the competition in the marketplace forcing you to do it. In the public sector, it's very, very difficult to do. Their incentives to do so are not endemic among managers in the public sector. So it's really important we start considering these kinds of things before we're totally under. The current budget problems are just a presage of where we're going to be in the future. The governor and the legislature have just nibbled a teeny bit on the big problems in the state's budget, both the structural budget and the unfunded liabilities in health care and pensions for our public employees.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like nibbled a bit is the right way to describe something when you have a $30 billion cut in the budget from what it was 5 years ago on a base that's now $90 billion. I mean, I count that as 33%. That's nibbling? If I go and take some of the kids' foods, their sandwich and take a third, they're not telling me I'm nibbling.
Well,
they're
first
telling me I'm taking a good portion of
and
their
you're,
sandwich.
You're, first of all, you're measuring off of a boom and a second revenue boom base where a lot of stuff got funded that shouldn't. That's number one. We have made some cuts. It's not wonderful.
It's
I understand.
30,
let me finish.
On, Michael,
let me finish.
Admit when you see
let me finish.
Big.
May I finish, please? You can have your turn. Okay, that's number one. Number two, in Governor Brown's budget this year.
All right, let's be respectful. All right,
let me just finish this point. Governor Brown's budget raises spending 6%, K-12 education 13%, while it cuts and puts UC students and their tuition against their jobs in the future by the demanding this outrageous tax hike to do it.
Let me just add another topic, if I can, to all of this, and including what we're spending money on, the revenue we're getting, our schools, and it's immigration. You know, we're a state where people come from other places. I came from someplace else. I think most of us probably did. But a lot of us come from other countries as well. Where do you put immigration, Deborah Saunders, on the scale of these problems? Is it a net plus? Is it a negative? Is it like how should we be viewing it? And, you know, do we need to change the way we view it?
Well, I think that immigration has been great for California, and it's also taken a big bite into the budget. We have a lot of kids who are going to school. When you have a lot of immigrants, legal and illegal, you have a lot of low-wage earners, and that's going to change the way a state works. I mean, that's what it is. I think that immigration has made the state great, but I also think it's costly, and I don't really know what you do about that.
Well, but I think what you do is you try to invest in those people, and you realize that you've got a situation where we're lucky. We do not have the population pyramids that Florida has, which is lots of old people and not many young people. We got a lot of young people. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure we educate those people in K-12, and by having a robust higher education system, and after all, the CSUs and the UCs train about 80% of the people in college in the state of California. The privates do a very small piece of what's done. So those are the places you want to invest in. We invest in those things. We're really going to have a tremendously robust economy in the future.
You know, I wish all of you had the opportunity that I have to teach undergraduates in this university, at the University of California, Berkeley. I have one unit on immigration. And every year I ask how many of you were either born outside the United States or how many of you have parents who were born outside the United States? And do you know that 80% of their hands go in the air? And these are superb students. You know, I've taught at Harvard. I have been to Dartmouth, and I've done a blah, 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 blah. I have never encountered students as eager, as bright, as I have here at UCal Berkeley.
Motivated.
Unbelievably motivated. And, you know, I even have students, 2 weeks ago, one came to me in tears because she was an undocumented worker. Her parents were undocumented. She had come here at the age of 3. She had been with valedictorian of her high school. She got into the California Community College system, which is the real crown and the jewel. It's the unsung hero of the education system because that's the first way you get in. And she did so well, she got into Berkeley. I raise this only because when we say that money is not correlated with quality in education, I agree with that to some extent. It's not sufficient, but it's necessary. There's not a way that we at the University of California can continue to provide the quality of education that these students need, Michael, even with online learning. We're not going to be able to have a faculty of the excellence we have if we don't have more resources. In K-12, how do you attract real talent to the classroom? Well, you don't do it by simply asking people to take huge pay cuts. You don't do it. I mean, the law of supply and demand is not eliminated at the door to our classrooms in this country or in California. If we want very talented men or women to go into our classes and teach, we've got to pay them enough to make it worthwhile for them to go in our classrooms and teach. And this is true of, you know, this is the human capital versus financial capital. Look what we are paying people on Wall Street to be custodians of our financial capital relative to what we are paying our teachers, even though California teachers, some would say, are paid higher than the median.
Michael, what's missing?
They're actually about the highest paid in the country in the public system. But I totally agree with you. We need to pay good teachers more than they're making now. The problem is pouring money in that can't happen in the current system because the unions won't let it happen. They resist merit pay. It's hard to get rid of underperforming or really poor teachers. Now, California is not the only place that has this problem, but in a variety of other states, they're making more progress than we are here on everything from education to pension reform.
Well, and I agree with you.
Governors of both parties are doing that.
I would trade merit pay for some chance for the really good teachers to make a lot more money. I think that would be a great deal, and I wish we could get there.
I want to take some questions from the audience because we've got some good ones. And we sort of touched on this earlier, and it's Prop 13. We alluded to the property taxes. It is the elephant in the room. People see it in different ways. It's blamed for all of our problems. Others say, no, it's really exaggerated. They blame the lack of funding for schools on Prop 13. We're not going to resolve that now, but is there anything we could agree on, that you could agree on, should be done or should try to do to change Prop 13?
I would get rid of the two-thirds rule for taxes, and I agree with conservatives that that might very well lead the Democrats in the legislature to start spending like crazy. But I have enough faith in democracy to believe there would be a counter-reaction to that, and the people would say, no, we don't want that. But the good news would be is we'd have two things occur if we got rid of that rule. And the first one is people would know who was responsible, absolutely, for sure. And second of all, we'd get some things done. And it seems to me you want a political system there you have responsibility and a chance to get things done, and I think that would do that.
Anybody agree with that, Deborah?
What I'm watching is, I mean, this is something that we saw in the 2008 election. The view of who should contribute and who should have to pay taxes is really changing in this country, and I think California has been a forerunner in this. I was really surprised when Barack Obama talked about he wouldn't raise taxes on people who made more than $250,000. That was his limit. That was middle class. Mitt Romney said the same thing this week, and people jumped on him for that as well. That was considered sort of a skewed view of middle class, that you would consider, I mean, the median income is around $50,000 a year for a household, and yet we have this political group that thinks that the burden for government should be carried not by the middle, but by that group there. So we have a state where we keep telling everybody that we can keep having more government and we can just ask this little narrow group to pay for it because nobody else really has a responsibility.
Yeah, but bring it back to Prop
13. So the two-thirds vote. Oh boy, you want to chase away people who
Deborah,
who
I think it's a lack of nerve on the part of conservatives. They don't believe in democracy and therefore they don't want to have it and they don't actually want to have things get done.
Well, actually, I can't think of a better thing for the Republican Party than having a majority vote for tax hikes. Because if people actually realize that they might have to pay for it, I think it would change how
that's what I'm saying. And if that's true, then that's fine.
I know there's a lot of emotion flying around right now. Let me just mention a couple of facts about property taxes. Prior to the recent collapse, they rose 5, 6, 7% a year, year in and year out. The notion that we were being starved for revenue was a bit exaggerated. That's number one. Prop 13 did a variety of things, and you can argue some were good and some were bad, but in any event, it's not the fact that property taxes stayed at the level they were in the mid-70s. They've risen considerably. Secondly, you can't really think about the funding of education without considering some of the ramifications that occurred in California and elsewhere, a variety of other states. With the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court decisions that fundamentally overturned local financing of education. And however noble the intention was to try to make sure that people in poor communities were getting more resources, it's been a big part of the undermining of the consensus to spend more because of the tremendous bifurcation. It's an oversimplification. Basically, the money flows to Sacramento and then gets sent back on a formulaic basis, and people don't have enough of an incentive to deal with what's going on.
I think that's right.
That's right.
So I think it's worth mentioning that.
Yeah. Isn't the governor trying to change that?
I think that's right. Realignment is so important. He's trying to do that in a variety of areas, especially criminal justice. I think that's great. I think if we can push more of it back down to the local areas. But we've got to make sure they have the taxing power to do the things they want to do, by the way, if we're going to do that, to make sure that we don't overburden them.
But the inability was to do that with schools.
Let me get back to your point about Proposition 13. Just context. in the late 70s, and starting in the late 70s and continuing thereon, you had tax revolts thundering across this country. Why did it start all in the late 70s? Well, the other thing that began in the late 70s was the slowdown in the growth of median incomes in this country. And today, the typical male worker, adjusted for inflation, his wages are approximately what they were three decades ago. I mean, you've had a stagnation of median wages across the country that has made the tax burden a particularly palpable and powerful issue for a lot of people who, during days when before that their incomes were increasing, taxes were simply more acceptable. They could bear that kind of tax burden. The other thing that I wanted to say, well, just to summarize, we cannot talk about what has happened to California and California's tax base without acknowledging the stagnation of median incomes and the concentration of a lot of wealth and income at the very top in California and around the country. But the other thing that I wanted to mention was that California increasingly sends more money to Washington than it gets back from Washington. This is a particular disease of blue states that tend to subsidize red states. I think it is time.
Redistribution of wealth.
I think that yes, it's a major redistribution, and I think we ought to lead the country back to states' rights.
I agree.
Absolutely. Just to get people the data on that, in the early 1990s, and I think it was Henry earlier on mentioned that the demise of defense spending in California was part of what was going on. Back when California was the recipient of 20% of the Pentagon's budget, California got back something like 93 cents of every dollar California shipped to Washington could be traced back to California in everything from defense contracts to Social Security benefits. And that number is now 73, 75 cents, and we're like 45th or something among those, despite the fact that we've had a very powerful representation in the Congress.
We have several questions about ballot measures, but I want to ask a general question. California has the most powerful form of direct democracy in the world. The voters are all powerful here. If something is passed on the ballot, only the voters can change it. In light of that...
the Supreme Court of California
except for the courts. Yeah, except for the courts. Exactly. Yeah, and that happens from time to time, but not very often. In light of that, I mean, you know, we've got this ballot box budgeting situation. Henry Brady, anything you can think of to... Is that how big a part of the problem is that?
Well, I think it's a big part of the problem. The budget is just festooned with requirements of things you have to do and makes it very difficult to actually make changes and good changes in the budget. One thing we could do is start saying things like any initiative would be sunsetted after 5 years, 10 years, something like that, or that at least it would go back to the legislature that would have to decide whether they were going to continue it or not. The people could still come back and have another initiative if they didn't like what the legislature did, but at least we wouldn't have these things engraven in stone and just sitting there forever and ever. We've got a Constitution that's 200 pages long. Look at the U.S. Constitution. It's about 20 or 30 pages.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think these initiatives really are examples of direct democracy. They may have been in the progressive era. But what we see now is you have to have a certain amount of money in order to get something on. And so a handful of very wealthy people or interest groups can raise that money and put it...
on the liberal and conservative side.
Yeah. But, you know, there have been in the last couple of years, some very, bipartisan, I think, well-intended organizations like California Forward that were trying to build some consensus around some of these kinds of changes. They got nowhere. They got no money, no support, and they basically closed up shop. Why?
This is, I think, a terribly important question, Scott. And again, as a relative newcomer here, here's what amazes me. You've got a culture, a history in California of the business community, of civic leaders, of others coming together and making major reforms. I talk to executives from Apple or Google and say, do you feel any responsibility for joining with other leaders of business and civic leaders and others in leading the way toward fundamental reform in California? And you know what I get back? No.
Why is that?
Because one theory is that they are global companies. They can get the talent wherever they want. The key design and R&D talent they can find here, but they don't feel particularly responsible.
Is that a function of tech, do you think, or just generally business?
It may be partly a function of tech, I think. I think the tech folks are... it took Microsoft a long time, for example, to realize that maybe they should have an office in Washington, and, of course, what made them realize it was an antitrust case. Those tech companies seem to be focused on other kinds of things.
But isn't there a bigger argument, too, that the reason these California Forward-type groups die is that the powerful groups like the way things are. They have the power. They can go to the ballot box when they want to change something and raise the money to get it passed.
By the way, stop something. Governor Schwarzenegger found this out. He had three, I thought, fairly commonsensical initiatives, and he wound up getting personally vilified with $100 million of negative ads. Balancing the budget and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The rainy day fund. Bob mentioned we should have a rainy day fund. We did have one. It got raided immediately as soon as there was... It wasn't even a recession as soon as they just wanted to spend more money. So.
I think Schwarzenegger tried to take everybody on at once, which was part of his problem. It was pretty obvious to anybody who knew politics to begin with that was probably a mistake.
Well, and Schwarzenegger is not popular in the Republican Party, is he?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask about that. He was
the people who were
he was he was very popular early on after he was defeated in these initiatives he tried to pass to make, which would have, I think, address some of the issues we've all raised about the inflexibility and the problems and the imbalances in the budgeting. Maybe not everybody likes exactly how they were done, but they would have made some progress. Later on, he governed not so much as a Republican.
Yeah. He wasn't in Tampa.
Well, a lot of people weren't in Tampa. Let me we've got a few minutes left, and I want to come back to this idea of, we are in the 21st century. We have an old constitution that's 200 pages long. Just recently, Amazon, which represents the new economy, has agreed and is going to begin collecting taxes from vendors that do business on Amazon. What else do we need to do in California to have our revenue systems and our expenditures and accountability systems reflect the reality of 2012 and beyond?
Well, we've already talked about a number of structural changes, and I think I'm surprised at the degree of unanimity, not on every one of them, but on many of them. The real sticking point, and I want to come back to this, is the political will to make these structural changes. Michael referred to just now the point that you have a lot of vested interests that like things the way they are, but it's not sustainable. We're not on a sustainable path, and even those vested interests will presumably understand that. Not only is it not sustainable, but it's not a fair path. We are not doing well by our young people, and that, it seems to me, is not only unsustainable, but it's immoral.
Henry Brady, what would you ask? Add to that, rather.
I think Bob's right. I think there's been a lot of things people have mentioned that I think have been good ideas for trying to do things. I actually happen to think Prop 30 is important. Now, that's, I must admit, a bit of special pleading. I'm at the University of California. We're facing a $250 million cut. That's $1,000 per pupil at the University of California if that doesn't pass, and that's very frightening. We've already gone through a situation where about 6 or 7 years ago we had $23,000 per pupil at the University of California from the state. We're now down to $10,000 per pupil. If Prop 30 doesn't pass, that's another $1,000 cut. That's an extraordinary amount of cuts to take. And by the way, tuition has not made that up. So we've become a lot more efficient at doing what we do. And I would argue we're much more efficient than most private universities at this point by quite a bit.
Yeah. Deborah?
Working for the San Francisco Chronicle is painful at times. A number of my old colleagues who were here, we've seen the paper downsized, and I think this whole country is going through a great downsizing. It's awful to watch. It's horrible to walk by empty desks. And it's something that someone who believes in the market, I also know the pain of the marketplace. The state government hasn't gone through that downsizing yet. It's got to do something about... I'm sorry.
Numbers I just described not sound like downsizing?
But here's the thing.
What is?
Okay, but there are things that are on automatic pilot pensions, health care. And there has been, and Sacramento hasn't done what it needs to do to put, I mean, believe me, working at the Chronicle, I can tell you about what's happened with pensions and with health care. And there are things that corporations have done or the Guild has done in order to try to curb costs. Sacramento just hasn't even begun to deal with all the stuff on automatic pilot. And there's nobody who's come forward also to take care of the other automatic pilot parts of the budget. And until that happens, I'm not sure that people will go for Prop 30 because they know that, that they're not seeing the changes that they want to see and the reforms they want to see.
Well, there is also a lack of trust, isn't there? I mean, I've heard many voters say, you know, I would vote for it if I was convinced it really is going to go to the schools. And maybe it will. But, you know, then we hear about a slush fund with the Parks Department that didn't exist. And, you know, it just it's a little small amount of money, but it does undermine trust.
I think we also need a much clearer, maybe this program will continue to contribute to it, a much clearer, more honest discussion of what these numbers are and what's actually going on.
We need transparency.
Amen. Good for you.
We have it.
Well,
in a usable way.
Yeah, yeah. What I was referring to are things like, and both sides do it, all sides do it, trying to put the best gloss on something. So Governor Brown comes up with a 5% pay cut. That is going to be painful for some public employees, saying he's really being tough. It turns out it's 4.6% after a 3% raise temporarily for 5% fewer hours. You know, we have the pension reform. He says he's getting really tough. They passed this. He says, well, it's not enough, but it's a landmark move. It's for pensions for people who are hired next year and on. It doesn't touch any pension. When will that make a noticeable difference in California's spending and the drag on California's budget on education and everything else? 20, 30 years from now? We haven't noticed the state and local governments aren't exactly major hires right now in a soft economy. But let me give you a couple of examples of things that could be done. I've mentioned a couple, trying to be in the nature of reform, getting more out of the dollars, and hopefully if that happened, we'd build up trust to have us do what we need to do. So in addition to things like wheeling units to take a more integrated view of some of the services, California has roughly 45% of its employees who are scheduled to retire in the next 10 years. Every other organization is figuring out ways to use technology. We could easily replace half of them, hire half as many people going forward of those that are retiring. So by attrition, you'd reduce this. You'd save much more than the proportion amount because they're the highest paid, and figure out ways to deliver services through technology that are probably do a better job and certainly a more effective and efficient job. Now, there would have to be some other things being done. Not everybody will be able to access things through technology and so on. What I find kind of most offensive is the failure to even start to think about these things in Sacramento.
What happens to those people?
Well, those people are... I'm not talking about people who are currently working, 40-something percent of them are due to retire in the next 10 years. They will retire, and we have a major opportunity to restructure the nature of how we deliver services so we don't have to have as expensive a workload, and we can spend some of that money on things that will better deliver services that we need.
Yeah. You know, we're almost out of time. But, you know, Henry Brady, Jerry Brown, the 1.0 version when he was governor, was such an innovator.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Flat Tax.
He isn't right now so much. Do we need him to do that again, or does he have it in him?
Well, I'm with Michael Boskin. I mean, I think there's a whole lot of things that could be done to rethink how we do government. I'm the dean of a public policy school. I think we must do that. I think that's the way we're going to get trust back. I'm actually very proud of the University of California right now because I think we're trying to do these things. We're thinking about online education. Our dean's meetings every 2 weeks, we get together and we talk about how we're going to change the way we deliver services at this university to do it even better and to use new technologies, and that we must do that. So I think we're trying to do that here. It's not clear to me why we can't have more of that in other government agencies. I mean, I do know some reasons why that's so. We're a sort of funny government agency. Not funny, haha, but peculiar one. Luckily so, that has a little distance actually from Sacramento, and that's probably to the good.
Bob Rice, final thought. What's at the top of your wish list?
Well, we've already talked about education, and that really is my passion. I think it is the passion of an awful lot of people in this room. And if we don't do that right, Michael's right that it's not going to be a panacea anytime soon, but if we don't do it right, we're all going to suffer. And the least
totally agree.
Efficacious among us are going to suffer even more. The wave of immigrants that we've talked about can be and will be a huge asset to the state. That's the way past waves of immigrants have been, but we do have to educate them better, and that means, again, more resources. One final thought about pensions and health care. Americans in the private sector have seen their pensions disappear. They used to be, defined benefits. Now, then they became defined contributions, and now they're do-it-yourself 401ks. Americans are struggling with the healthcare increases in terms of deductibles and premiums and copayments that are soaring. That is not necessarily, a fortiori, a reason why we should put public employees in the same position. In other words, rather than think about public employees as being privileged and reduce their benefits to match private sector workers, maybe we ought to think about raising private sector workers' levels of benefits to match public employees. The race to the bottom in this country does not work ultimately.
All right. Deb, last word.
They're not funded, and there's something the matter with the city saying that we can't hire new cops because we're paying, because we have so many retired cops that we have to fund. So the problem is we're not paying for it.
Yeah, Michael.
One thing that hasn't been talked about that I think is important, and it builds on this issue of the inflexibility that governors of both parties and even some in the legislature have run up against, which is that there's a proclivity of judges to invoke very strict interpretations or even fanciful or unusual interpretations of language. And so you have things, for example, that if you've already started a job, some judges have said you cannot change pensions for the next 50 years for that person. A change defined as the 3% escalator stays forever, even if the city's bankrupt, and then it'll show up, you know, on the state's books, or if it's a defined benefit pension program, it'll show up on the public pension guarantee corporation. All of this needs to get rethought in a fundamental way where we bring our resources to bear in the most effective way to have an effective government providing the necessary services that we need, that government should provide. The government should not be trying to do everything. It does too many things in many places. And there really is an opportunity to do this. If the way we try to deal with it is through short-term fixes, which are very tempting, it's not just ideology. You know, when you're in trouble, you try to plug the leak immediately. We really need to rethink this and get it right, as Bob said about education, on a wide swath of things. We have a prison system where we pay more per incarcerated inmate than the average take-home pay of a family. We probably have too many people in prisons, too, because of three strikes. Some of those people probably shouldn't be in prisons. But the fact of the matter is we have to rethink all these things, and we should be having debates about those things, not just trying to have kind of last-minute arguments in the legislature about who's going to cut what deal to cut who and how and this sort of stuff. We really need a fundamental dialogue about this, and I hope this will contribute to that as we move forward.
All right, well, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you all, Michael Boskin, Robert Reich, Henry Brady, Deb Saunders. Thank you.
You've been listening to a KQED Public Radio Public Affairs special, Tax Revolt 2.0, Who Will Pay for the Society We Want? This program was presented on September 20th at the David Brower Center in Berkeley. It was co-sponsored by KQED and UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy and the Cal Alumni Association. The recording engineer was Jim Bennett. Post-production engineer was Howard Gelman. For KQED Public Radio, I'm Tara Seiler. Thanks for listening.